As many of you know, partly because we've been announcing it for a long time before, and also because those of you who follow me or the synagogue on Facebook or Twitter saw pictures, I spent the last week in Thailand. And I'm, in fact, going to begin this morning by showing you something that you almost never see in Thailand. Very rare sight in Thailand. But actually, when we had our Shabbat dinner and we needed a challah, the people at the hotel Googled an image and had the bakers make one. And it was pretty good. So we have actually had twist Thai challah. Sorry. And a Shabbat service in Thailand, which is a rare enough thing. And I want to tell you why we did, and what it was about, and some impressions of what it's like to be Jewish in a country, and there aren't that many like this, where Jews have virtually no history. Most places you go, you can hear both about the Jewish contribution and about how they persecuted us. In Thailand, really, you have not much of one or of the other. But you have a lot of statues of the Buddha. And how Jews feel about that is going to be part of this as well. About 20 or 25 people from across the United States and one Sinai Temple member, Angela Madahi, joined me in a trip to Thailand with the American Jewish World Service. Now, let me first tell you about the American Jewish World Service, because among Jewish organizations, it's pretty rare. There are Jewish organizations that help Jews, and then Jews often give to non-Jewish organizations. But there are very few, there are a couple, but very few Jewish organizations set up to help non-Jews. And I'm going to return to why that is in a moment. But American Jewish World Service works in 19 different countries, all of them countries that are called sometimes the Third World or developing countries, like Liberia, Nigeria, Burma, Cambodia, Thailand, and others. Some of them, like Ghana, Sudan, have suffered tremendous violence. Others, like Thailand, have in fact never been colonized. Thailand was never colonized, not by the British, not by the French, not by the Belgians, by no country. But all of them suffer in one way or another from serious human rights issues, poverty issues. In other words, they live in conditions that our ancestors were fortunate enough or smart enough or blessed enough to have escaped. And American Jewish World Service goes into these areas not to give charity, because as we all know, charity is a temporary contribution. You give money and then you're done. But instead, to help groups inside the country that are fighting for change in their own country. So they work, for example, across Africa with groups that support war widows, that fight against child slavery, against child marriage, that help literacy, especially for women. And they work continuously with these groups, not once, but over and over again, which means that those 19 countries and 500 NGOs, NGOs are non-governmental organizations, in other words, charities that don't work with the government but work with people to support sometimes policies that the government's not thrilled about. Those 500 NGOs, you work with again and again, you revisit them, you check their progress, you give them advice and help, you build a relationship. That's what American Jewish World Service does. And when they asked, would I be willing to go and to expose their work to the synagogue, even though we've had the president here a couple times, and I'll mention her in a minute, I said, of course. And we looked at various countries that they were traveling to this year. And with our schedule and theirs, Thailand worked. The woman who runs it used to be the mayor of the borough of Manhattan, and she's spoken from this bima a couple times. Her name is Ruth Messenger, and in her early 70s, she is still schlepping from country to country and helping people in all these countries and doing quite remarkable work, because even though we stayed in nice hotels, the truth is that it is not easy at any age to continually go to countries with different time zones and work with people who have sometimes very difficult lives. In Thailand, the aim was primarily to meet with groups who work both in human rights and also in what are called land rights. That is, people who've been working the same land for generations, and for purposes either of a large company or of the government, people come in and say, okay, we're now taking your land because that's what the government has the right to do. And the problem in part with that is not just that you lose the land that you've been working, but also something that I never realized, although had I thought about it, I suppose I would have realized it, which is it's a very different thing to be poor in a village and to be poor in a city. And given a choice, you'd much rather be poor in a village. Because think about the slums of a city. Think about what it breeds. Think about the culture that is created in a place like the slums of New York, Los Angeles, or Bangkok, as opposed to a village where it may be a little bit of a struggle to eat, but everyone knows everyone, everyone supports everyone, everybody has a little bit of land, everybody has a much more sort of pacifistic, unviolent, calm, and livable culture than if you take the land from those people and they're forced to go to the city. And so part of helping people who are poor is understanding the culture of poverty and the different kinds of poverty. And also understanding something about the culture of the country, which you can't get from one visit, but you can get a little bit. And let me tell you, though I had never been to a Southeast Asian country, many of you have, many of you have been there repeatedly, but let me at least tell you a couple of impressions going from Los Angeles to Bangkok. First of all, everybody took different plane routes. I went through the Hong Kong airport. And let me just say a word about the Hong Kong airport. You don't need Rodeo Drive if you're stopping at the Hong Kong airport. Every upscale store you can imagine is there and duty-free. No, I didn't buy anything, but I looked a lot. And one of the things you realize is that the culture of travel is a culture of wealth. Why do you have those stores at the airport? Because the people who are stopping in Hong Kong and going on to somewhere else or living there are generally people who are very well-to-do. Because essentially, and this is just my quick observation, there are two kinds of stores at an airport like Hong Kong or Bangkok. There are the very upscale stores, and there are the schlocky tourist stores. So you can buy some carved animal for nothing or an Armani suit. Those are basically your choices. And that tells you something also about the cultures of the countries, which is there's a very big gap between rich and poor in most countries, as there is, in fact, in our own. And then you land in a place like Thailand, and you're struck, first of all, by a quality that doesn't exist very much in America. We have many wonderful qualities, and I was very happy to come home. But one quality that doesn't exist so much is graciousness. There is a certain graciousness, not only in the way people greet each other with the why, that is, by putting your hands together and bowing, which in America would be seen as ironic. Obviously, someone's making fun of you by greeting you that way. But there is, in fact, a way of paying obeisance, that is, respect to someone else. And to walk by someone and just say hi casually is seen, as in fact it is, as being a little bit dismissive. Two, the way in which everything is attended to aesthetically. That is, there's a certain culture of conscious beauty. And it's not extravagant beauty, it's just conscious beauty. So even little things are arranged very carefully because that's part not only of an ancient tradition, but of a sense of graciousness. That's not so true in America, and you notice the difference. The other thing you notice is that there are a lot of statues. And as you go through the city, each of the temples has a Buddha, because 95% of Thailand is Buddhist and about 5% Muslim, and 7 Jews, who accidentally got off at the Bangkok airport. And of course, one Chabad, probably. But it's mostly Buddhist, and Buddhism is, in one way or another, in the East at least, a religion, although people don't speak of it as a religion so much in the West. They speak of it as a contemplative system. And one of the things that my guide said to me as we were driving in was that Buddhism in Eastern countries is very different from the Buddhism that you learn, say, at Berkeley. That is, it's a serious religious system with sanctions, with an idea, of course, of karma and what happens to you as you return life after life after life, with prohibitions, with allowances. In other words, in some ways, it doesn't sound so different from Judaism. In fact, as we were driving in, the first thing he says to me is, you know, Buddhism works by a lunar calendar, which means that every few years we have to add a month. Isn't that ridiculous? And I said, us too. And then he said, by the way, you're here during a vegetarian festival, which we were. There were yellow signs all over because there was a big vegetarian festival. He goes, because even though Buddhists eat meat, we're conscious of the fact that eating meat involves killing. So we try to do something to acknowledge that, in fact, even though we're eating an animal, we are killing it. And I said, us too. We call it kosher. And then he said, you know, the thing about Buddhism is that a lot of people practice Buddhism sort of, but really they don't understand it so well because they don't really study it the way it deserves. And by then I was tired of saying us too. So I just nodded and looked out the window. But this by way of saying that religious systems always have some similarities, even though obviously there are a lot of differences between Buddhism and Judaism. Among them, that every place you go, the centerpiece is a statue, either of a sitting Buddha or a reclining Buddha, and that the statues are almost always either covered with real or simulated gold, because the opulence of the temple is in part a bit of its allure, a bit of why it's considered so sacred. And that you don't get so much in Judaism. Although we have a few beautiful temples in our history, the truth is that most places that you visit in the Jewish tradition, even temples that are considered very sacred and very old, are not gold-lined, magnificent masterpieces of Jewish architecture. But we were there, of course, not so much to soak up the culture. And in fact, I didn't do that much cultural touring since the only day we had free was Shabbat. which is not a great day for rabbis to tour around Bangkok, but to help. And here, I just want to make two observations about helping people who really have very little connection to Judaism and no particular tie even to the political situation that we think, of course, everybody is interested in. The first is that for many people in Thailand, this won't surprise you, we are the only Jews they have ever met or probably ever will meet. We went to a small fishing village and met there with a group, by the way, which was partly Muslim. Believe me, they don't have a lot of exposure to Jews. Then we go to a small village in the mountains where this is how remote this village is. There's no internet service. That's how remote this village is. That doesn't mean, by the way, that there are no iPhones. There are. There was a kid sitting there playing a game on an iPhone. I didn't want to tell him, if you had internet, could you waste time? But there too, I don't think they've ever seen anybody wearing a kippah in their lives. And in fact, through the translator, several people asked me why I was wearing what I was wearing on my head. And this serves what is, in fact, a very important purpose that Jews don't always think about, which is that when you show up to help, as opposed to tell people how great we are, because we weren't actually going to all these Thai villages to let them know how many Nobel Prize winners Jews had. When you show up just to help, people get a specific impression of what Judaism is about. Our guide, one of our guides named Piju, who was a translator at the last meeting, said, you know, when people show up to help, they're generally like fireworks. Very bright, and then they're out. But AJWS, she said, keeps coming again and again and again. You see people, and then you see them again in a year or 2 years or 5 years, and they remember you because these are the Jews who come to help. And we don't sufficiently think about the fact that because the idea is you're supposed to be an Or LaGoyim, that is a light to the nations, that you can't do it if you never do anything among the nations. If you only have your light on at home, nobody else sees it. So part of the idea here is a very pragmatic idea, which is we're supposed to do things among the nations so that they will see what it is that Judaism is about. But the deeper idea, of course, the more significant idea is this is what Judaism is about. Nowhere in any Jewish scripture that I'm aware of will you see Jews must only help other Jews. It doesn't exist. Some Jews will tell you that. But Judaism doesn't tell you that. In fact, just this morning we read the opposite. The exact opposite. Why does Abraham challenge God? Because God is about to destroy the city of Sodom. Why does Abraham care about the Sodomites? Why does he care about people that have no relationship to him, that aren't Jewish? He's not trying to save Lot because God's going to bring Lot out of the city. He's trying to save everybody else. They're not Jews. Why should he care? But obviously he does. Because it says specifically, you will be a blessing to the nations. It doesn't say you'll be a blessing to the Jews. It says you'll be a blessing to the nations. And you can't be a blessing to the nations if you never do anything for them. Jews who have complained so often of their treatment at the hands of other people have to look at how they treat other people. And it was such a wonderful thing to be able to go into a village and to help. And when people say, why are you helping? To be able to say, because we're Jews. This is what Jews do. We help. And we do it again and again. And it leads sometimes to unexpected encounters, like the Muslim man who said to Ruth Messenger, through a translator, you know, I had heard some bad things about the Jews. Yes, even in Thailand. He said, but I've also heard some good things. And now I see who you are, and I'm going to go home and show my kids the movie Life is Beautiful, which, as you may know, is a movie made by an Italian filmmaker about the Holocaust. So that they can have some idea, he said, of who the Jews really are. That's a powerful thing. And that much more when you're in a place where you get to shape the image of the Jews, because it's not France, it's not England. It's not a place where people have developed idea about Jews and Judaism. It's a place where they're encountering it for the first time, where you won't find a challah in the street corner, where they have to Google the image to find out what in the world a challah is. And where the people who run the hotel stand there and watch as we gather in a circle and sing Shalom Aleichem and make Kiddush. And they get to see, these Buddhists who grew up in Thailand, a little bit of what our tradition is about. Now, I don't know when or if we'll take another trip. There are a lot of things to do and a lot of places to go. But I hope that one day we will, and that more people will consider coming and meeting people in all these countries and seeing how it is that they live and what it is that they hope for and how we can help them. The first day that I was there, and on every AJWS trip they invite a rabbi to come and to teach something about the tradition and how it applies to the situation both in the country and to what the Jews are doing there. The first day I was there, I taught a lesson about the story of Joseph. As you'll recall, maybe the second or third day, as you'll recall, Joseph has these dreams. And he tells his brothers and his father about the dreams, and they end by trying to kill him and throwing him into a pit, selling him into slavery. And when he ends up in Egypt, he finds himself in jail. In other words, dreams get Joseph into a lot of trouble. Almost killed and imprisoned in a foreign country. And while he's there, the cup bearer and the baker hear that here's this guy who is a Baal Chalomot. He's a master of dreams. So they tell him their dreams, and he interprets them, one favorably, one unfavorably. And as a result, since he has this reputation, and since the cupbearer lives, when Pharaoh has dreams and doesn't know what they mean, he says, I remember this guy Joseph hanging out in prison who might be able to help you, and he does, and we know the rest of the story. He rises second only to Pharaoh and is able to feed his brothers and his family when they come during a famine. So a while ago, Rabbi Isaac Bernstein, an English rabbi, asked the following question. He says, dreams get Joseph in trouble, and dreams get Joseph out of trouble. What's the difference? And his answer is, the difference is that Joseph got in trouble when he could only listen to his own dreams. When he learned how to listen to the dreams of others, then he triumphed. And that's what we were doing. And that's what I want to suggest that Jews learn even better how to do. We know our own dreams. But other people have dreams too. And our tradition tells us that you begin with yourself and your family. Im ein ani li mili. If I am not for myself, says Hillel, who can I be for? But then he goes on to say, "Shani rak la'atzmi ma'ani." But if I am only for myself, what am I? So we were there, to be not only for ourselves, and therefore to learn who we were. And we are the Jewish people that was created not just to support one another, but also to help to bring light to God's world, even to places where they don't know who we are. But now, a little bit more, they do. Shabbat Shalom. Shabbat Shalom.